The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back. Friday, September 18th, 2020. The huge breaking news is that Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, has passed away. Obviously, send our communal thoughts and best wishes and prayers to her family and friends. And obviously, pulling up our socks and girding ourselves for a massive new twist in this presidential campaign. Who knew this year could take so many more stresses? What will come next? I don't know. We'll get through this. I said in the last hour on this that I would be surprised if the Senate actually takes up a nomination prior to the election with only 45 days to go. There are good arguments to do so. Hugh Hewitt wrote that as a practical matter, holding hearings quickly are a necessity because the court should be at its full 9-member complement should any election disputes have to go before the Supreme Court, as they did in Bush versus Gore. You don't want to be in a place where you have a 4-4 tie or anything like that. There is perhaps another way around this, though. Despite the point Hugh's making, and it's a good one. If you can avoid that, Donald Trump only this month has released publicly a list of people he said would be his potential nominees to the Supreme Court. It's a list of, 15 or so potential nominees. It includes not only former Solicitor General Paul Clement, which is a name that some of you might know, but at least as by memory goes, 3 United States senators, Ted Cruz, Tom Cotton, and Josh Hawley, as well as some others. I don't remember if this iteration mentioned the one I would be very, very much delighted to see, which is a judge who was recently, a couple years ago, confirmed to the 7th Circuit Court based out of Illinois, based out of Chicago, Amy Barrett. I would love to see that nomination to the ultimate seat on the Supreme Court. She, of course, if you don't remember, is the one when she was up for that seat on the 7th Circuit, was grilled so harshly by Dianne Feinstein over her Catholic faith. Remember Dianne Feinstein's line to her that her Catholic dogma lives loudly within her? I thought it was a terrible thing to say. Donald Trump has released his list. Pressure will now be on Biden to release his, I should think. And this will make things far, far more interesting. When you look at what the left wants in a judicial nominee, it's pretty far out there. And it's pretty easy to get the records and writings and statements and debates of what these nominees or these candidates have said. And it's pretty far out there when you think about what the left wants. The reason I'm talking about that is you look at the problem Joe Biden has had to struggle with in trying to maintain the facade of being a moderate to the American public while continuing to guarantee his commitment to the left and the progressivism of AOC and Bernie Sanders to that side of the Democratic Party. This is their greatest desire, the court. The court is their greatest brass ring. They will want Joe Biden not to nominate a moderate. And when you look at the kinds of stuff left-wingers support when it comes to the judiciary, including everything that we've talked about in the culture wars, everything we've talked about with regard to race-based preferences and, of course, life issues, also gender issues, it's not going to be comfortable for the Democratic Party to try and sell that to the American people. This puts an awful lot of pressure on Joe Biden. It's going to be this is going to be a battle royal, and I am happy to take your calls on it as we discuss it. Rob in Surprise. Hi, Rob.
Oh, hi, Seth. Yeah, first of all, rest in peace, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I totally oppose her ideology, but I respect the fact that she was a Supreme Court justice. I also think that, yeah, everything that I'm seeing coming online now, of course, is putting her on a pedestal. And yet, I mean, she just doesn't or never got the whole original intent of the Constitution by the founders. And again, this is part of the problem with the left, the Democrats, and anybody that thinks that the Constitution is this quote-unquote living, breathing document. No, it's not. It says what it says, and it is designed to limit the power of government and to give the maximum rights to the individual American. And nothing, I believe, will ever change that, nothing will ever change my thinking. But that's part of the whole leftist strategy. And I, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, I think I'm right about this. And that's why, you know, despite kind of, you know, giving sympathy to her passing, this provides an opportunity, again, for America to get back to its originalist roots. Am I wrong about
that? No, you're absolutely not. You're absolutely not wrong, Rob.
Yeah.
And I was just doing a little bit of history here on my own research. And, you know, it's a funny thing the way the Democrats handle this and the way the Republicans handle this, this being Supreme Court nominations. And it happens, obviously, yeah, at other federal nominations, too. But when it comes to the Supreme Court, look at the way Democrats don't defer to Republican nominations. Look at the way Republicans do defer to nominations. Ruth Bader Ginsburg was approved by the Senate on a 96-3 vote. 96-3. Brett Kavanaugh was 50-48. Just as an example, 52-48 for Clarence Thomas. We handle these different ways. And so the question naturally arises, do you defer to the president? And this is the question senators wrestle with a lot, and so do a lot of legal constitutional scholars. Do you, as a senator, defer to the president on his nominations, or can you vote against a nominee based on their ideological, based on ideological records and criteria and presumptions? And I remember doing a big research project on this, and there is a tradition of both. There is a tradition of both. I would ask you, how do you handle that question? Do you, if you have a nominee before you, Rob, and you're representing the state of Arizona on the Senate Judiciary Committee in Washington, and you have before you a Democratic nominee, do you vote to approve them if they have an immaculately fine personal and public life, even though you disagree with their jurisprudence?
Oh, absolutely not, Seth. I mean, I'm more of the Neil Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh originalist kind of guy, and I think that's the one thing that seems to be missing is that the left wants judicial activism, and they want to go around Congress to get that, and he represented all of that.
Hold that thought. Let me take a break. This is the big pregnant question. Hold that thought, and I'll come right back to you if you don't mind the quick brief wait, Rob. I really very much appreciate it. We'll be right back. If you haven't checked out and pre-ordered your DVD to watch TrumpCard.com, Dinesh D'Souza's latest film, I want to urge you to do so. Go to WatchTrumpCard.com. That's WatchTrumpCard.com to pre-order your video on demand and DVD of Dinesh D'Souza's latest film. It exposes in vivid detail the corruption and gangsterism that defines today's modern Democratic Party and reveals what's unique about today's socialism, who's behind it, why it's wrong, and how we can work with President Trump to stop it. That's WatchTrumpCard.com now. Rob is in Surprise weighing in on the news of Ginsburg's passing. Rob, you were saying, were you a U.S. senator on the Judiciary Committee? Or really, for that matter, you don't have to be. You can the full Senate does vote on these things. You would take judicial record into account, not just fitness of office, yes?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, the fitness for office, again, has everything to do with the originalist intent of the founders. And this sort of ties in, even though I was going to talk about, you know, you need to play more Rush for Bill and you need to play maybe more Huey Lewis in the news for me, but I'm funny that way. Anyway,
I'm good with the second part, and I'm okay with the first. Good is a little better than okay, right? I'm good with more Huey Lewis. I'm okay with, you know what? Let's be nice, Bill. If you want to find a Rush song that you like and throw it into our bumper, go ahead. There.
Yay! I prefer the Big Money, but I just like the song.
We were here to please Bill, Rob.
All right. Well, yeah. I mean, I think of Conrad, of course.
Yes, Conrad. Yes.
Yeah. But I also think, you know, this sort of ties into one of the reasons I was calling earlier, which is, I think, actually, after reading your and Chris Buskirk's book about American greatness, I think I figured out the unified field theory of conservatism, which is America first. And I think everything else pales in comparison to that. And, you know, it's funny because I believe that was the founder's intent based on everything I've ever read, based on all the documents and the Federalist Papers and the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. It was all designed to place American interests first. And Donald Trump is doing exactly that. Yeah. And yet, you know, we still have the Never Trumpers who, and again, in your and Chris's book, pointed out that, you know, this was what, Conservatism Incorporated?
Yeah, I Conservatism think. Inc., yeah.
Mm-hmm. Inc. And they missed it. They missed the point completely. And they still miss it. Yet he, more than any other president, I think, since Abraham Lincoln, has been doing exactly what the founding fathers wanted the president to do and what he wanted America and Americans to be like.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I keep thinking it's so simple and obvious and staring at us straight in our faces, yet people are still missing it, including especially the Never Trumpers, that America first is the most important conservative principle. Maybe even Bill Buckley may have missed that too, or maybe he was alluding to it. And because over the past 60-odd years, you know, conservatives and, you know, Never Trumpers in particular seem to have missed that as well. America first was really the first most important conservative principle that has ever existed. And Donald Trump is here doing that, and yet he still gets resistance from, you know, the left, the media, the usual suspects, the academics, the public school system. And I guess I thank you for teaching me so many things, but I think it's true. I think the original intent of the founding fathers was to place this country first and American interests first over everything else that goes on. And again, correct me if I'm wrong, Seth, but something scares me because I think I'm right.
Well, you know darned well, and I could use a stronger word, that
I know
if the Democrats held the presidency and the Senate, and it was a Republican nominee who passed away, they pull out all the stops. You know this would be full speed ahead.
Yeah, and they always do.
And they always do. And you know the way they play this game. I give you Brett Kavanaugh. I give you Clarence Thomas. I give you Robert Bork. What's going to be interesting, just as an aside, is Joe Biden's role as chairman of the Judiciary Committee again during the Thomas hearings, because you know this is something he doesn't want brought up. It crosses all of the tripwires, especially when it comes down to, do you remember the story, him seeking Anita Hill's forgiveness and she not and she not giving it to him?
Yeah, I remember it well.
And he went on The View, Joe Biden. Did you remember what the perspective from the ladies on The View was? What took you so long? Why did you wait till you were running for president to call Anita Hill? Now, I don't think he should have called Anita Hill, and I don't think he owed her an apology. But in the left world, he did. And she wasn't willing to give it to him. This is going to bring all that up again. Now, on this issue of voting for someone because of their perspective, their judicial philosophy, I have to tell you that I think that it's bifurcated based on whether it's a nomination to the presidential, to the executive branch, you know, like a cabinet member, or whether it is a nomination, as in this instance, to an entirely third branch. And I think the senators owe deference, quite frankly, when it's in the executive, when it's in the executive purview. So when it's a cabinet member, I don't think they have the Senate. I don't think advice and consent extends so far as to reasoning, ideology, perspective. But I do, and I think we're in agreement on this, I do think it should extend to the judiciary, which is an entirely third branch, because a Supreme Court justice is not supposed to serve a member of Congress, a senator, or the president. They are supposed to be entirely independent in a third branch. And I think, therefore, this is a perfect separation of powers ideal. President nominates, Senate makes its decision. And quite honestly, I think the argument should be made, if it isn't, could be made, that the Senate would be consigning and giving away their constitutional authority by giving deference when it comes to the appointment to a third branch.
Absolutely right, Seth. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend.
You do the same, Rob. We'll talk to you soon. Smitty, don't go away. Wayne, don't go away. There's room for more. 602-508-0960. Let me put in a word for balance of nature, if I can. I take it every single day, and I haven't gotten sick a single day since I've started taking it. You get improved health, boosted immunity, energy through the power of all 100% whole food plants, fruits, and vegetables in vegetarian capsules you take just once a day. You get tens of thousands of vital nutrients, 10 servings of 31 different fruits and vegetables. Go to balanceofnature.com and use discount code BALANCE to get free shipping and 35% off any new order. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Everything takes second and third tier to the issue of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's passing, and we go to Smitty in Scottsdale. Long time no talk, Smitty. How are you, sir?
Oh, very good, very good. So you and I are totally in agreement that Amy Coney Barrett is the best nominee, and I would say at this point, under the circumstances, she is the only candidate, only person on the list that could be nominated at this point because she's going to be the least controversial. And
I don't know about that. I don't know about that, but she just based on how Feinstein and Democrats have treated her before. but she's the most easy to defend, I think. I think.
Well, maybe that's the best. She is the most defensible.
Yeah.
If I would also say that no later than first thing tomorrow morning, whatever formally has to be done to nominate her, it should be done no later than first thing tomorrow morning, because I'll bet you Schumer and his minions have already got an injunction in the works ready to be filed if it hasn't already been filed. And they will find a judge over the weekend to file it.
I hope not. You might be right. I just hope not. I would like to think.
Based upon what happened in 2016, they're going to go right at it.
I know. One thing I do want people to keep in mind, and what one of the arguments we're going to have to be prepared to summon. It's not hard. It's just I want our people to be informed on this. Is that nominations to the Supreme Court in an election year have a fairly long tradition. I mean, a lot of presidents have nominated Supreme Court justices in an election year. Franklin Roosevelt did it. Taft did it. Woodrow Wilson did it, I think, maybe twice, including Louis Brandeis. Herbert Hoover's done it. It is not a unique thing.
Nevertheless, it is going to be controversial.
Oh, my gosh. There's not a word for it, Smitty. There's no word. I don't know what the word for it is. Controversial is the least.
Well, amongst friends, it's our code.
Yeah.
The dumpster fire, you know what, poop storm.
Yeah. Thunderdome.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and look, based upon what happened in 2016, when the Senate wouldn't take up the nomination, Obama's nomination, it adds a little twist to
it does.
Things.
Yep.
And so I think you have to be prepared.
Yep.
And I think that rather in light of the fact that they will try to enjoin him from nominating, get the nomination out of the way, then it's only a question of whether you can enjoin the Senate from taking it up. And that's a different issue and a totally, you know, I'm not sure how you can enjoin the Senate from doing it.
I mean, my gosh, so that would have to go, obviously, ultimately to the Supreme Court itself, right? I mean, think of the machinations this goes through. Which at this point would only have three liberals on the court, right?
Yes, yeah. But remember, it takes it. We have seen over the last 4 years innumerable instances of circuit courts enjoining the president and ruling against the president's authority. While this is a constitutional authority, the root is no less familiar to the Dems, and that's the way they would go. On the other hand, if the nomination has already been delivered to the Senate, then it's a question of how do you enjoin the legislative the Senate from doing its constitutional duty.
Right.
And that's a whole different bailiwick. There's only one route for that. That's right to the Supreme Court. And I'm not sure there's a great deal of precedent.
No, I'm not either. But the court composition at that point would be 5-3, assuming assuming the conservatives hold shape. That having been said, Smitty, there was one other thought I had on this. What was it? I don't remember it. It'll come to me. It'll come to me about midnight. I had one other thought.
Okay.
Thank you, sir, for everything.
My pleasure. Good to speak with you.
You too. 602-508-0960. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. It's a great market if you're interested in selling your home. It's the marketing you want to think about. And when you think about the importance of that, you want to think about the greatness of James Wexler of JMG Real Estate. James Wexler sells more homes over $500,000 than any other agent in Phoenix and Scottsdale. How does he do it? He has a proprietary and state-of-the-art marketing technology which enables his customers' homes to be viewed by the widest pool of buyers. As a result, his listings sell faster and for more money. The Phoenix Business Journal ranks James the number one selling individual agent in Arizona for a reason. He guarantees to sell your home at market value, or he'll pay the difference. He can also make you an upfront guaranteed offer within 24 hours. You don't want to leave any money on the table when you're selling your home. James Wexler will ensure that you don't. Give him a call at 480-386-0711 or go online to jameswexler.com. That's James Wexler, WEXLER.com. I already have listeners that have reached out to him and are happy that they did so. Ruth Bader Ginsburg's passing is the story, obviously, of the day, and will be the story for the next week easily, and the week after that, and the week after that. I remembered what I wanted to share with Smitty, which was, in a way, so much of this could have been avoidable, right? Ruth Bader Ginsburg, at age 87, didn't retire last year. Excuse me, in 2016 or 2015, when because she was banking on the fact that she would be replaced by Hillary Clinton. She was banking on the fact that Hillary Clinton was going to be able to replace her. That gamble is what didn't pay off. But they were the ones who rolled that dice, and they have put us in what will be an extremely tension-filled situation. Wayne is in Chandler. Hi, Wayne.
Hi. I first have a question, and that is, have you seen the videos produced by the producer of VeggieTales that discusses systemic racism?
Nope, I haven't.
It's worth watching.
Okay.
That's 20 minutes or something. You look it up on the internet, YouTube. But the point being, we know that blacks disproportionately are in prison, but they disproportionately to the white population are guilty of more infractions. The question is it because inherently they have less respect for authority, or is it because the system is biased against them? Now, my point being, the welfare system in this country, which is really in God's purview, it's through the temple or the church, not the domain of the government. But the government has destroyed the family with the structure of the welfare system. So fathers are absent. So we have this system that perpetuates problems lacking the father role guidance in the family for black families. So these are deeper questions, but my point is I have come to believe that the system is, as a minimum, stacked against black people. Now, I'm an old white guy, so I'm not, you know, biased toward them because I'm black, but I have a southern heritage. My father was born in Louisiana in the early part of the last century, so you can imagine his perspective on things. And I'm saying now, can we do something to address this issue? And it has taken, well, it might be 250 or 300 years creating the issue where we are today. And it won't be solved in my lifetime. I understand that. But can we do something to bring more qualified people, the Ben Carson types of the world, who have grown up in the system and understand some of the nuances that maybe you and I do not, into the system to try and figure out where we go from here? So my question is there a really good, qualified, female, black judge who could be and maybe should be considered for Ruth Bader Ginsburg's seat? And if we saw President Trump nominate a black female judge, the liberals would blow their minds collectively.
Yeah, I know, right? That's what immediately came to my mind when you suggested it. I knew one who I was privileged to know one out of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and I think originally from California, named Janice Rogers Brown, who I was privileged to work with a little bit on one project some years ago. She's retired, and she's of course aged probably out of the possibility of doing so. I think she must be in her 70s at this point. And there may be others. I don't know. I just honestly don't know of them. I'm open to that suggestion, obviously. Not that I'm anybody, but I like the cut of it, Wayne. But that having been said, I'm always hesitant to play a game I would never invite others to play, if that makes sense.
Agreed.
And the idea that we have to look for someone based on a characteristic not of their own making, what used to be called, or maybe sometimes is still called, an immutable characteristic, gender, race, ethnicity, perhaps even place of origin, birth of country of origin. The idea that should replace the measurement of the mind, or dictate, or determine, or inform the measurement of the mind, is odious and anathema to me. And that having been said, there are things, you're right, this country needs to do to engage in what would you call a civic healing? Healing, is that the right word to think about it? But
at least a deeper understanding.
Yeah, sure. It might start, though, with the shoe on the other foot. It might start with the idea that Candace Owens doesn't have to fight tooth and nail with her own publisher to get her book published, because the publisher doesn't like her perspective, and that when Ben Carson raises his head and raises his voice, the left does not shout him down. It may start with that kind of sentiment. The vicissitudes of life intrude into political preconceptions. If you thought this election's contours were identified by issues having to do with COVID or China or the economy or fracking or the environment or the Green New Deal, they've all just become subsumed today by the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, again to whose family and friends we extend all of our condolences. In part, the problem and the subsuming is resultant of the ethic that, as I said earlier, was identified as long ago as by Alexis de Tocqueville in Democracy in America, that there's no political question in the United States that does not turn into a judicial question. The left and liberals have made that so. But regardless, it has become that. And as de Tocqueville continued to say, that is exactly why judicial decisions become part of our language. In fact, the language not only of the legislator, but the language that we know in our schools as well. Judicial decisions, he said, infiltrate all of our society. That's why these things are so fraught. Would that Ruth Bader Ginsburg had retired in 2015 or 16 and not banked on Hillary Clinton's becoming president and spared us the situation we find ourselves in now. Would that all jurists of a certain age and health thought more broadly that way? We'll pick it up on Monday. Until then, I want to wish you all a happy new year for those who are celebrating that, and a strong and safe weekend. God bless, and class dismissed.